Hello and welcome. This is JJ Virgin of JJVirgin.com with another fabulous expert interview. And I have one of my favorite people on the line today. I hope he's on the line. Are you there?
I am.
Are you there? This is Dr. Tom O'Brien. And how long have I known you? Gosh, a long time.
Feels like a lifetime.
Is that good or not good? I'm not sure. So I love the information we're going to share today, and we're going to have some fun with it, even though this could be kind of a potentially scary topic, and it is a very serious topic as well, because what you're going to hear today is that if you have this problem and you mess up, it could kill you. So what we're going to talk about today is gluten, and we're going to talk about it from everything from mild gluten sensitivity all the way down the line to celiac disease, because I think there's a lot of confusion out there on gluten, and if you don't have celiac, that it's all fine and dandy, and that's not the truth at all, which is why we've called this call Put the Breadbasket Down, how gluten may be destroying your health and, most importantly, what you can do about it. So let me tell you a little bit about Dr. O'Brien before we jump in, and so you'll know that I have a true expert in this field, and I think you're probably going to tell your story of how the heck you got into the whole world of gluten, right?
Sure, happy to.
Yes, because I'm looking here and I'm going, well, to me the most interesting part of the story is how you actually got interested in gluten, because, you know, you clearly have a really solid background in nutrition, wellness, medicine. As a grad of the University of Michigan and the National College of Chiropractic, he's also, let's see, you've got all these ones, diplomat of the National Board of Chiropractic Examiners, diplomat of the American Board of Clinical Nutrition, certified clinical nutritionist with the International and American Association of Clinical Nutritionists, certified applied kinesiologist, certified practitioner in functional biomechanics, and a member of IFM, of IAACN, of the American Chiropractic Association, etc., etc., etc. And I know you're also, you went to the functional medicine AFMCP program. You've been presenting all over the place. I know I pulled you in to present at our NAMP conference because this is information that has to get out there, and I just am so surprised at, like, the scarcity out there in the consumer world about this and the confusion. So my goal today is for you to, you know, really clear up a lot of the confusion about gluten, what it is, where it's hiding, how it can hurt you, what the real truth is behind it, you know, because I think people think if a doctor hasn't recommended that they might have celiac disease, then they're fine. How you can know if you have an issue, and then what the heck to do about it. All right?
Yes, it sounds good.
Yes. There we go. That's what we're going to cover. But, you know, I think what's so interesting is, you know, you started out in chiropractic and nutrition, and how did you become, I mean, you're kind of obsessed with gluten, it seems like.
I am. I am obsessed with it. And I think probably what would be jaw-dropping to your listeners is I got a phone call 3 years ago, and my godmother was on the way to the hospital, and I said, what's wrong? And I said, we don't know, some kind of stomach pain. Her medical history was that she was never in the hospital in her life, she was 82 at the time of this call. Once in the hospital in her 60s for a car accident that broke her hip. She was there for about a week, but never before. She was on no medications whatsoever, ever in her history, except for pain medication with the broken hip for about a year. Healthy woman. Every year she'd go to the doctor for her physical, and the doctor would say, Emily, you're as healthy as a horse, except you have to stop drinking. And Emily would look at her and say, I don't drink. And she didn't. It would be a joke at weddings. I'm half Italian, and so we would toast the bride and groom at a wedding, and Aunt Emily would pick up a glass of water and be as loving and compassionate and toast just like the rest of us. And we'd say, Emily, how'd you get in this room? You're not one of us. You don't drink. You don't drink vino. You need to leave. You know, we'd tease her. I mean, we consciously would tease her because she wouldn't drink. But her doctor would say, Emily, you got to give up drinking. Why? Because she had mildly elevated liver enzymes. No other indicators of a problem, just mildly elevated liver enzymes. And all doctors know, they see that rather frequently, where there's no symptoms, no other alarm signs, and so it's kind of like, you know, you turn the car off and it spitters and sputters for just a second before it goes off completely, but then next time you start it, it runs fine, so you forget, you know, you just kind of watch, and doctors watch it and they wait and see. The next year, she get a physical. Emily, you're as healthy as a horse, but you got to stop drinking. And she said, what's the matter with you? I told you last year, I don't drink. And this went on, apparently, for a number of years. I never knew about this. So now, let's fast forward. She's rushed to the hospital with severe abdominal pain. They find out she's got 4% of her liver left functioning, 4%. The rest of it is all sclerosed, like an advanced alcoholic about to die. And they did emergency surgery because when you see, all the blood in the body goes through the liver, but now all the blood in the body is going through 4% of the liver. So you've got 100% of the blood in the body going through 4% of the liver, and those blood vessels in that area are designed to handle 4% of the blood. But now they're having to handle 100% of the blood. What happens to the blood vessels? They burst. She was bleeding out, internal bleeding, severe stomach pain. They rush her to the hospital. They save her life because they patch up the bleeding blood vessels. She had 6 more surgeries in the next 2 months, emergency surgeries, because the blood vessels kept bursting. Because what are you going to do? For an 84-year-old woman or 82-year-old woman, you're not going to give her a new liver. She's not going on the transplant list. If she was 30 or 40, she would go on the transplant list because she was healthy and healthy lifestyle. But at 82, you know, they're just going to do the patch-up surgery. So after the first surgery, I find out what's happening. And I called my cousin and I said, Cindy, have the doctor do this blood test, transglutaminase and deamidated gliadins. And she said, well, why would I do that? And I said, because this might be the mechanism that's contributing to your mom's problem. Because by then I heard about this, Emily, you got to stop drinking thing from the doctor.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it amazing that the doctor kept saying that to her and never...
Every year.
But, I mean, and she would say, I didn't drink, and he never thought, huh. I mean, that's what's so mind-blowing to me.
Exactly. You know, they're just so busy.
I mean, it was
busy.
Handed to him on a platter.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Or in a wine glass, rather. I don't know,
yes,
but
right,
he didn't ask.
Right, in a blood vial, right. But he's just so busy, and he's got so many people he has to see. He doesn't have a lot of time, right? And so if it doesn't stare him in the face with exactly what to do, they say, all right, well, it's not too dangerous. Let's just watch it and wait and see what happens. Because she was healthy-looking. Everything else was okay. You're right. So 3 weeks later, I hadn't heard anything, so I called my cousin, Cindy, what happened? She said, oh, Tom, the doctor said you're probably a nice man, but you really don't know what you're talking about. And this is the leading hepatologist in Pittsburgh, right, where they live, at Carnegie Mellon. And so I, you know, what can I say? I would have liked to have sent him an article. I was just too mad at the time I didn't do it. But in the journal Hepatology, which is the major medical journal for liver specialists, Mayo Clinic wrote an article in 2007 that said mildly abnormal liver enzymes may be the only indicator of celiac disease. The only indicator. And this is in the major journal from Mayo Clinic, and that's what she had, mildly elevated liver enzymes. But that doctor had never read that article, so he didn't know about this. So Emily had 6 more surgeries in the next 2 months. And then finally, the surgeon said, Emily, make your peace. We can't do any more surgery. It's just too paper thin in there. And she said, how long do I have? And she said, I don't know, 2 weeks, 2 months, we don't know. But just make your peace. So I found out that's when I went to Pittsburgh to say goodbye to my godmother. And that was a pretty, you know, that's a difficult thing to do. And so you ever say goodbye to someone that's known you longer than you've known you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah. I stayed 3 days and I woke up one morning early and went out in the living room, and she's sitting out on the couch and on the sofa. And I said, Emily, what are you doing up so early? She said, I can't sleep. And I said, well, lay down. And she said, I'm too old for you. She just started laughing. That was my godmother. And I said, I know, but if I can't have your body, I want your blood. Lay down. Because I'd brought a barrel and a needle and a tube, and I drew her blood. And I called the lab, and I said, this is Dr. O'Brien from Chicago. Come get this blood now. And they sent a driver over, and they got the blood. They ran it stat. She's a celiac patient. So I had a family meeting that night with my cousins and my aunt and uncle, and I showed them the results of the blood test. And, Emily, this is likely what caused the problem over many, many years, just slow. Because when you have mildly elevated liver enzymes, you're killing off liver cells. And, you know, we lose liver cells every day, and so there's a normal amount that we lose, because that normal number is determined because you make new cells every day, you lose some cells every day. So as long as you're making as many as you're losing, you maintain a neutral total number. And that's the normal reference range. Well, she was outside the reference range. She had mildly elevated liver enzymes, which meant she was losing more cells than she was making. And this went on for decades, from eating wheat. Decades. And the result was she only had 4% of her liver left. So I went to say goodbye, and I reviewed this test with him, and I said, Emily, I don't know how long you've got. I really don't know. But I can promise you this. You're going to feel better if you never eat bread again. And I had brought some gluten-free pasta with me, you know, and some samples. And we cooked dinner that night with rice pasta, and it was really good. Everybody said, oh, this tastes just like regular pasta. And so we passed the Italian test. And so bottom line, she lived a year and a half. Not 2 weeks, not 2 months, a year and a half. And every day, family was over there. I have a big family in Pittsburgh. Every day there was cousins and aunts and uncles there, you know, just to hang out with Emily for a little while, knowing that she might die any day. I mean, it's a weird place to be, that, you know, if she bursts one more time, she's going to bleed out and die. And so people were there every day and just happy and joking, and, you know, I'd call from wherever I was to check in, and they'd say, where are you? And then, you know, in the background, they'd say, hello, hello, and there was always someone there. She lived a year and a half. And when you have advanced liver cirrhosis, like she did, it progresses into hepatocellular carcinoma, liver cancer, which it did, and that progresses to brain cancer, which it did. And, you know, but she was on no pain medications, no medications whatsoever, occasionally an Advil or a Tylenol, but nothing, no Tylenol, an Advil on occasion, but nothing else, no other pain medications. And then I get a call that says, any day now, any day, because the brain cancer and the liver cancer had been progressing. So I went back to see her, and I immediately flew to Pittsburgh, and she was 53 pounds. The cancer had been eating away at her body for a year and a half, but she was conscious and present and talking to family, and she became quite spiritual and started to speak from another place, in a sense, you know, a lot of truths about, you know, how you've been treating your wife, you got to stop doing that. You really need to look in your heart and see the man you want to be. I mean, she said that to one of my cousins. And I mean, she just became much more present. And she always was present with us, but much more present. And she was 53 pounds, you know, and I sat at the side of her bed, and we held each other's hands and looked in each other's eyes, and we were just crying. You know, I had tears running down my cheeks. And this is my godmother. And put my head on her lap, and she was stroking my hair, you know, and it was a tender moment I'll never forget. And I lifted my head up and looked at the love in her eyes, and I was just sobbing, and she said, thank you, Tommy, thank you, because she had a year and a half with the family. And then she got this spark in her eye, and she looked me just penetrating and said, you tell him. And I said, I will, Aunt Emily. I'll tell him. That's why I'm fanatical about this, because her death certificate, she died 2 days later, her death certificate said brain cancer secondary to liver cancer. It should have said brain cancer tertiary to liver cancer secondary to celiac disease. It was wheat that killed her. Just slowly, steadily killed her. And we'll get into all this, the difference between celiac disease and gluten sensitivity. But bottom line, it can affect any tissue of your body. There's 18,000 medical articles in the literature about celiac disease and how it can affect any part of your body. 18,000 articles. It's not just in the gut. So that's why I'm passionate about this.
Is that she didn't? It didn't have to. I mean, it didn't have to happen. I'm looking at a client I have who, you know, had to have her colon removed.
Yes.
Because they never found it. They misdiagnosed her. They never even looked for celiac disease.
Yes. Yes.
So
let's
jump right into it, because I mean that's why I'm so glad you're on this mission, because it's amazing to me. I had a client like this, she couldn't gain weight. She was from India. Beautiful dancer. Everyone thought she was anorexic because she was so thin. in reality, she was eating like a pig. I was amazed at what she could put away, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Everyone's like doing, oh, no, she's lying. I'm like, oh, no, she's not. The food recalls are too detailed, you know?
Yes, yes.
So I'm going, this doesn't make any sense. I thought, let's look for a gluten problem. And the first thing I just did was pull the gluten out. Let's just pull the gluten out. Just take it out.
Yeah.
All good. She's great. Week later. Change person.
Yeah, of course. A week later. Right.
A week later. And meanwhile, I just ran a little simple adrenal test where they, in that one I find so often doesn't show it, but sure enough, it showed that she was reacting to gluten, IgA there. And then she goes to her doctor. Her doctor goes, oh, well, you know what? None of that's conclusive.
Right.
You are going to have to go back and eat gluten so that I can retest you. And she's sitting going, oh, no, I'm not going to eat gluten. It hurts me. No, you have to.
Right. Right. It's,
oh,
that's a historic misconception. And the current papers, and I've got maybe five or six papers, and there are more, but that's the only ones I've downloaded on it, that say you do not need to do the challenge test any longer. That is not required for a diagnosis of gluten sensitivity and celiac disease. It's not required. But old-time gastroenterologists still believe you have to do it, and if you don't do it, we don't have evidence, so it's okay to eat wheat. I mean, it's archaic.
Yeah,
it's archaic.
It's amazing. So, okay, so let's talk about that, because I think people, if you say celiac, they go, oh, is that where you can't eat bread, you know? But they don't really know what the gluten intolerance is and what the difference is. So what I'd love to talk about is what are the differences and really how can you know if you have an issue, you know, from one to the other?
Sure, of course. That's my full day, 8-hour seminar, my full day gluten
and you
seminar.
Have 5 minutes, go.
Right. Which I'm here's a little plug. I'm doing it two more times this year in Las Vegas and in Nashville in December for doctors and healthcare professionals. All right, celiac disease. What's celiac disease? Celiac disease, your intestines are a tube. There's about 25 feet or so of this tube winding around in your abdomen. The inside of the tube is lined with shag carpeting. This shag over here is where calcium is absorbed into the bloodstream. This shag for magnesium. This shag over here, vitamin C. This shag, proteins. This shag, the good fats, the good oils. All the shags absorb different nutrients. That's how we get the benefits of food into the bloodstream to rebuild the body and keep us strong and healthy. It's got to go through the shags. Celiac disease is when the shags wear down and you've got berber. And if there's no shags anymore, you don't absorb calcium. You get osteoporosis. It's not rocket science because you can't absorb the calcium. You eat it and it goes out in the bowel movement. Your patient, your Indian dancer, she was eating like a horse, as you said, and she wasn't gaining any weight because it was going out in the bowel movements, because her shags are likely worn down or they're inflamed and their absorptive capacity has been diminished. That's celiac disease. And the technical definition of celiac disease requires that the shags be worn down completely and is called total villus atrophy. If you don't have total villus atrophy, the gastroenterologists are trained, you don't have celiac disease.
You mean if the disease hasn't been with you so long that it's completely damaged you, you don't have the disease?
That's exactly right. How archaic is that? Excuse me, and with no disrespect to the doctors, because they're just following what they were taught in school, how archaic is the concept? I mean, that's kind of like saying, and many patients have had family members that have had a heart attack who survived, and they said, you know, my doctor said I had a heart attack before this that I never knew about. And he said, really? He said, yeah, they could see the evidence of the heart attack, you know, dead tissue in the heart from previous heart attacks. That's like saying, so if you're checking a patient in a physical, do they have cardiovascular disease? If they don't have evidence of a previous heart attack, they don't have cardiovascular disease. No, you don't have cardiovascular disease. It doesn't matter if your cholesterol is 350. No, there's no evidence of a heart attack. You don't have cardiovascular disease. No, you don't have celiac because your shags aren't worn down. What kind of nonsense is that? I mean, that's the end stage of multi-year problems eventually wearing down the shags to where there's nothing left. So there's earlier stages, but they don't qualify for the diagnosis of celiac disease. So gastroenterologists are kind of caught with their hands tied behind their back. If the biopsy comes back negative, they really may suspect the problem's there, but they can't technically give the diagnosis for insurance purposes, of celiac disease, because the definition requires total villus atrophy. That's the conundrum of diagnosis. But there's so much earlier stages. It starts with fire in the belly. First, there has to be inflammation. Then the inflammation causes the tissue to get damaged, to be worn down. Then you start getting partial villus atrophy. Then you get total villus atrophy. It's a long-term, step-by-step, progressive disease.
I'm still so flabbergasted that they don't consider it to be a disease until it's done all of its damage. I don't really even see the point of finding it out then. You're already done.
That was the diagnostic criteria that was set in 1958, and it's held ever since. You know, it's dogma within the world of gastroenterology. But now, in the last 3 years, there is such a strong movement saying, wait a minute, what about the earlier stages? And there's a stronger movement for that, but it's not accepted yet by the American College of Gastroenterologists or the British College of Gastroenterologists. You know, these official organizations that decree what the guidelines are, they've not accepted it yet because there's not enough studies. Which,
Wow. Nonsense.
There's so many studies. But as a consumer, as a human being who's sick, you don't need to wait for the American College of Gastroenterologists to agree, after so many studies have conclusively proved this, that it's okay to address it at the earlier stages.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's not like you're saying, hey, we're going to put you on some toxic drug. We're saying, pull gluten out of your diet. You know? Wait a minute.
That's the other problem, is that there's no profit in this. There's no drug, and so there's no profit, so there's no momentum for change except from the grassroots level.
Well, amen to the internet is all I have to say. Amen to you and the internet for getting this word out here, because that's how I think we can really make the change on it.
Yes. So that's celiac disease. Now, imagine an iceberg. Above the waterline of the iceberg is the term gluten sensitivity. Gluten is a protein that's in wheat, rye, and barley. It's actually in almost all grains, but the toxic types of glutens are in wheat, rye, and barley. So don't freak out if you read somewhere that there's gluten in rice or there's gluten in corn. Yes, there is, but it's not the toxic type. The toxic family of gluten proteins is in wheat, rye, and barley. So put gluten sensitivity above the waterline. And then, of course, with an iceberg, you know that what's below the waterline is much, much bigger than what's above the waterline. Well, if it manifests in your gut and wears down your shags, it's called celiac disease below the waterline. If it manifests in your gut and it shows up as heartburn or projectile vomiting in children, it can be called GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disorder. It's called GERD. If it manifests in your bloodstream as pernicious anemia, which is still a problem of the gut, it's because your body's not making enough hydrochloric acid, you don't absorb your nutrients very well, you get anemia, that form of anemia, it's called pernicious anemia, but it's a gut problem. If it manifests in the brain, it's called attention deficit, or epilepsy, or schizophrenia, or depression. Now, not every patient with depression or schizophrenia or epilepsy has gluten sensitivity, but a large majority of them do, a large majority. So if it manifests in the kidney, it can be called nephritis. If it manifests in the joints, it can be called rheumatoid arthritis. If it manifests in the skin, it can be called eczema or psoriasis. Not every psoriasis patient has gluten sensitivity, but somewhere around 30 to 70% of them do. Depends on what study you read. So my point is, above the waterline is the term gluten sensitivity. Below the waterline is the whole gamut of how it might manifest.
Wow.
So that puts it in perspective right away. So bottom line for the doctors, what do you look for to suspect gluten sensitivity? Anytime your therapies aren't getting excellent results, anytime a patient is trying to be healthy and following a gluten-free diet, they're following a conscious diet, they're eating, trying to eat good foods, you know, they're trying to live a healthy life and they want to be stronger and more energy, and it's not working, think about gluten because it might be one of the foods you're eating that's causing the problem. Fatigue is present in 100% of the patients that have gluten sensitivity, but most of them don't know it. And as you know, when you ask a patient, well, how's your energy level? They say, fine. Now,
right.
So
they have no idea what good's really like.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And if you ask the question properly, you say, on a 1 to 10, 10's the amount of energy you should have. 5 is half as much. Pause for a minute. Now, take your willpower out of the equation. What's your true energy level? So when you pause after asking the question, 5 is half as much, pause, they've got a number immediately in their head. But then you say, take your willpower out of the equation, and you see their jaw drop, and their face just go, oh. Because we all rev up our engines to keep us going. And when you get the honest answer, they'll say 2 or 5. And then I say, now that's a truth response. And you can't live there, so your lifestyle currently keeps you revved up so that you can do everything you need to do in your day, and that's good that you're doing that. But let's see if we can get your core energy up higher so you don't need to drink 3 cups of coffee a day, or you don't, and it's okay to enjoy a cup once in a while, but you don't need 3 cups a day, or you don't need to exercise for 2 hours every day just so you feel okay. You know, so that you don't have to rev your engine to keep it going, that your core energy level is higher by itself. And then you've got a patient that's right on board with you.
You know, it just sounds to me, and I mean, call me crazy, but it just seems like to me that...
You are crazy.
I know. What a rebel.
That's why I love you. You're crazy.
I'm going to say this really bold statement of like, wouldn't you just try pulling gluten out first? I don't know.
Right, exactly right. Exactly right. Exactly right.
I mean, we have this class that we teach called our Break Free Boot Camp, and it's breaking people free from the foods that hold them hostage. We also do it in our detox program. We just pull it out because
yes.
I know, I found, and you know, I don't know if you're going to concur with these stats or say they're even higher, but I find that about 30% of the people, maybe even 40, feel better when they don't have gluten in their diet.
Yes. Gluten kills. That's the premise that you use. Gluten kills. It doesn't kill in a day or a week. It kills over 20 years, 30 years. I mean, there are so many papers on reversing autoimmune diseases by getting gluten out of the diet. I'm talking about lupus, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, recurrent miscarriages from antiphospholipid syndrome. Women lose babies, and they go on a gluten-free diet. They don't lose babies anymore. I mean, now, not every patient, not every woman that loses recurrent pregnancies is gluten sensitive, but many of them are. Man, this kills people. It killed my godmother. 50% of children on a with drug resistant epilepsy. Now, if you think what that means, your child has epilepsy, has seizures. You've been to the best neurologist in town. They referred you to a specialist because they couldn't help. So you go to the pediatric neurologist, and they can't help. The drugs aren't working. Your child is still having seizures.
And those are killer drugs, too.
That's
all
right.
The side effects of those drugs, I don't know.
yeah, they're bad.
They're unbelievable.
Bad.
I think.
But it's the lesser of two evils, you know, if it works. I mean, if you need the drugs, you take them. But 50% of the kids with drug-resistant epilepsy go into complete remission on a gluten-free diet. Imagine that. After all the sophisticated blood tests and the different drugs and the probably years of grief parents have gone through, just get wheat out of their diet and their child's fine.
Now, isn't it amazing? I mean, whenever I talk about this, it's like, you know, you just come back to, gosh, just start with what you eat, and so many things you never have to go further so often. It's incredible.
Yes.
But, you know, let's talk now, like, gluten, is this something, is it genetic, is it developed, how does it happen?
Because historically doctors have looked for total villus atrophy and celiac disease, most of the studies about cause are related to celiac disease. So my answer is, you know, I'm prefacing the answer to say we're limited with the number of studies so far. With celiac disease, almost 100% of those people have the genes for it. There's two genes, that are with associated with celiac disease. About 90%, 90 to 95% have one of the genes called DQ2, and 5 to 10% have the other gene, DQ8. So if a parent has celiac disease, you know your kid's carrying the gene. I mean, that's just a given, and you've got to check the kids. You can't ignore and say, oh, no, they feel fine, because my godmother felt fine her entire life. Your child felt fine until they have their first seizure.
Well, it's interesting. I have the woman I told you about who had the colostomy bag. Anyway, she had to have her colon removed. I'm trying to remember exactly.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's
she, one of her daughters has severe stomach problems. I'm like, we'll get her tested. But when they tested her, she showed up negative.
Yes, well, that's...
Now,
that's,
I still think it's like, keep her off, but the...
That's my general public lecture that I do usually the day before I do my all-day lecture for doctors. The night before I do a general public lecture, I'm doing one in Las Vegas on Friday night, December, I don't know, I think it's the 5th or 6th. My website.
I'll be in Vegas. And then will you also, what's your website so they can keep abreast?
My website is www.thedoctor.com, T-H-E-D-R. Don't spell the word doctor out, just D-R, thedoctor.com. And
now,
it lists
do you have resources
my...
for the public on there too?
Yes.
Great. Yes. Okay. So everyone, so, thedoctor.com, go there, sign up so that you can keep updated, because I know you keep updated, so you'll keep us updated. Okay, so
yes.
so back to the whole thing.
Right. The title of my lecture in Vegas is The Conundrum of Gluten Sensitivity. The tests are negative, go off the food, you feel better. How's that possible? And so what happened, the testing is notoriously inaccurate. So let's just go to testing for a moment, if we can, because we're here.
We're jumping all over the place.
We are.
I'm a woman, but we do.
And I'm a fanatic, so on this topic. So put the two together, and it's look out. the research articles show the blood tests have a very high degree of sensitivity and specificity. That means they're accurate. Very high degree, 92, 94, 97%. All the studies show sensitivity and specificity is high for celiac disease. So all the doctors that do the blood tests believe that, well, of course, well, look, here's a study. The tests are accurate. Your test is negative. It's not a problem. Now, the problem is the tests are positive if you have celiac disease. But what's celiac disease? Total villus atrophy. If your shags aren't worn down completely, the blood test is wrong up to 7 out of 10 times. If you have partial villus atrophy, or if you just have the early precursors, which is the inflammation, it's called increase in intraepithelial lymphocytes, the blood test is wrong 7 out of 10 times. But doctors don't know that. So they're doing the blood test looking for celiac disease, but the technical definition of celiac disease is total villus atrophy. So the numbers that say, look, this test is right on the money, and they don't say if you have total villus atrophy, they just say if you have celiac disease. So there are new blood tests coming out in the next week or 2 weeks that are much, much more sensitive, much, much more accurate for gluten sensitivity, not just celiac disease. The whole world's about to change, JJ, in terms of recognition of this. The whole world, they no longer will get false negatives. Doctors won't get false negatives.
But how long is it going to take for the doctors to catch on to the right type of testing is the problem.
Well, you know what's so cool? I've got literally thousands of doctors, because I've been lecturing now for 5 years, I've got thousands of doctors who are waiting for these tests. I've been prepping them, because I've known that this is coming, and I've just explained this concept. So there are thousands of doctors out there that know about this. They just don't know what to do because they're in an insurance-based practice. They've got to have documentation to make a diagnosis and then to justify the treatment, but they can't make the diagnosis if the test comes back negative. So they're stuck. Now they're going to be able to identify it positively and give the diagnosis of gluten sensitivity.
Okay, and are you going to have a list to the doctors?
Oh, my goodness. Well, actually, the lab probably will. The lab, and there's a general public education forum on the lab also. The lab is www.cyrex, C-Y-R-E-X, cyrexlabs.com.
Okay. So if someone wanted to do this, though, the best thing, if they went to your site, they could find someone that could do it for
them?
Yes,
that's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. The general public will be able to get information on my site, also on the Cyrex Lab site.
Okay, so let's go back. So genetic versus, like, acquired versus, because it does, you know, are we seeing more cases of this because we're identifying them, or are they happening?
Really good question. We're seeing more cases of this because there are more cases of this. There's a study that came out in the Journal of the American Medical Association last September, and these guys at Mayo Clinic, and I talked to one of the head researchers in June. We were presenting together on the same podium in June. His name's Joe Murray. And these guys got access to 4,000 blood samples from airmen from 1948 to 1952 at an Air Force base in Nebraska. And it was such an exciting thing for researchers because the blood had been well preserved. It was frozen and well preserved. There had been some fluke accident where the refrigeration unit for this blood freezer had leaked just a little bit, so that the rubber stoppers on each blood vial didn't decay. I guess the lifespan back then on those things was like 2 years or 3 years, even when they were frozen. But because of the leakage of the refrigeration, these rubber stoppers were froze solid, and they didn't decay, so the blood was still good. So Mayo Clinic had the blood now of just over 4,000 airmen between 1948 and 1952. There weren't many women in the Air Force back then. This is around the time of the Korean War. And they got permission to check the blood to see how many of these people, how many of these young guys, virile, strong, vibrant, 18 to 22-year-olds, how many of them had celiac disease that they didn't know about, so that the blood showed that they had a problem. And they found the number of how many that did. Then
to clarify,
they looked,
this was only the guys then that would have had this full-blown, they've already destroyed their shag carpet.
No.
No,
The blood values can possibly be elevated before the shags are worn down completely, but 7 out of 10 times it won't be, but 3 or 4 out of 10 times it may be. So some of those guys did not have their shags worn down completely yet, and most of them did. Most of them did.
Okay.
So, but none of them had any symptoms that were bad enough to not be in the Air Force between 1948. Now, maybe they had a sore tummy or something. They had a little constipation. You know, who knows? But they weren't complaining of anything. Young, virile, strong, healthy guys. Mayo Clinic then went to their records of the same, or actually, I think it was about 5,000. Men, young, healthy men, 18 to 22 years old from Humboldt County, that's where Mayo Clinic is in Minnesota, that had come in for physicals that didn't have celiac disease, or who knew if they had them or not, but just 5,000 guys that they did blood work on, 5,000 18 to 22-year-old men today. It was like 2 or 3 years ago. How many of them have blood values elevated for celiac disease? And they compared, and they found that there's a 400% increase today than there was 50 years ago. 60 years ago now. 60
wow.
Years ago, there's a 400% increase. And there's no arguing with this data. There's no arguing because it was done so well, and this is the original blood from 60 years ago. And there's a 400% increase, meaning it's more prevalent today than it was 60 years ago. Four times more prevalent than
it
was.
So it's not just genetic. We know that then.
That's right. It's not just genetics, and it's not just that we're looking and identifying more of them. There's more of it going on.
And why is that?
Well, I asked Joe Murray about that, and he said, well, we think there are 13 reasons. We've come up with 13 possible explanations for it. And that's all he'd say. You know, he's a pure researcher.
He wasn't going to share, huh?
Yeah, he's a pure researcher. Well, what do you think? He said, well, you know, it could be any one of them. So I said, well, Kent, let me tell you what I think, and then you can tell me. And I said, what about GMO foods?
Mm-hmm. Those would be my guesses.
Yeah, because it's the 50-50 rule. In the last 50 years, the gluten content of wheat has gone up by 50%. They've genetically modified it so that it's more stable, it grows longer, it's more pest-resistant, you need less of it to have fluffy bread, but the way they do that is by having more gluten in it. So I asked him that, and he smiled. I said, well, that's actually high on the list. We think that may be a major culprit. But he's not going to commit to anything, you know, because anything he says, he's Mayo Clinic, right? He's representing Mayo. And so he's not going to commit to anything. But so there is more of it happening today. The next study that I want to tell you about that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, also in September of last year, I mean, it's just fabulous that both studies came out the same month in the journal. They looked at 351,000 biopsies. That means where they look at the intestines, they take a piece of the tissue, the intestines, and they look at it under a microscope. And they're looking for celiac disease. 351,000 biopsies. They found celiac disease in just under 30,000. So 29,000 of them had celiac disease. They found that the blood values were elevated, but the shags weren't worn down yet in just under 4,000. And they found that they just had inflammation in the intestines with the shags not worn down yet, but the mechanism is inflammation, but it was an earlier stage. They just had inflammation, and the blood values were not elevated, just inflammation in 13,000. So that's 30,000 with celiac disease, shags worn down, 4,000 with the blood values high, and 13,000 with no blood values high and no shags worn down yet, but the mechanism's there.
And what was the starting number?
351,000.
Okay.
So, I mean, this is the largest study, and they looked at how many people died in each category. This is the largest study of mortality in celiac disease, and the number of deaths exceed that of all the earlier studies put together. So this is the grandfather of all studies in terms of how fatal is this thing, what mechanism is dangerous or not.
Wow.
What did they find? They found that if you had your shags worn down, you had a 39% increased risk of dying early in life of something. Heart disease, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, you were 39% more likely to die if your shags were worn down.
And can I pipe in? Why are they not checking these people for osteoporosis? Because every single one I've looked at is already severely osteoporotic, too.
Yeah.
I mean,
hold on to that. Hold on to that pearl.
Don't say anything. Okay.
Yeah, hold on to that pearl for just a minute, and we'll go there. 39% increased risk of early death if your shags are worn down. 35% increased risk of death if you just had the positive blood values but your shags were not worn down. So how important is the biopsy? I mean, it makes little difference in mortality. But listen to this one. 72% increased mortality if you just had inflammation. Your shags weren't worn down, your blood values were negative, and you just had inflammation. 72%, double the risk of dying early in life if you just had inflammation. Double.
Wow, and we're all focused on cholesterol.
That's right. That's right. And as you know, and I'm sure you'll talk on, maybe we'll do one follow-up to this on the mechanism of inflammation. It's called intestinal permeability. And the leaky gut. And we'll talk about all the studies around that and how do you
I know, and
that?
I was talking to a doctor the other day, and he looked at me like, you don't really believe in that leaky gut, do you? It's not Santa Claus, you know.
Send him my DVDs, because I've got study after study after study about it and pictures of it and the mechanisms of it. There's no question about it. And if doctors don't know about it, they unfortunately, in their education, they weren't taught, and they haven't read the journals that talk about it since they got out of school.
So therefore, it doesn't exist.
Right, right. That's the danger of this thing, is the mortality is so increased with the mildest stage of this. The mortality is double if you just have inflammation and your shags aren't worn down yet. Now, let me give you another one of these statistics that just drops your jaw. This is in the American Journal of Gastroenterology. And the title of the paper, Long-Term Mortality in People with Celiac Disease Diagnosed in Childhood Compared with Adulthood, a Population-Based Cohort Study. That was the title of the paper. What did they say? Children diagnosed with celiac disease had a threefold increased risk of long-term mortality compared to children that don't have celiac disease. Threefold increased risk of dying early. Never eating gluten again. They're on a gluten-free diet. They still die early. Because all of the practitioners out there who know about this the protocol that they follow is what? A gluten-free diet. It's not enough. JJ, we need to do a whole thing about how do you heal. You have to heal
right.
the damage that's been done. And that's my main message going out there now to doctors. First is introduce them to the concept, but second, you've got to stop throwing gasoline on the fire. Of course you do.
But then you've got a whole burned out field that you got to replant, reseed.
That's
water.
Right. Actually, it's not just burnt out. You're right. The damage is there, but there's still incendiary fires going on. It's like a forest fire. It goes on for weeks and weeks and weeks, but in the body it goes on for months and months and years. That it's not just the damage that has to be repaired. That is true, but you also have to put the fire out. The fire is still there. You stop throwing gasoline on the fire, but the fire is still there.
And how's the top way to put the fire out is what?
If it were pharmaceutical, I'd say polypharmacy, meaning you take a number of different medications to get the job done. And I don't know the term yet. I'm trying to come up with like polynutrition, polynutraceutical.
Yeah.
But multiple types of nutrition that technically, let me say it this way, that multiple selective kinase response modulators that activate the kinase pathways to go upstream and quiet down the inflammatory cascade.
All right, now I'm going to make you say that to a seventh grader. and just tell me what would be your top 3 to 5 things that someone could throw on that, on those smoldering.
Vitamin D.
Okay.
Vitamin D. Fish oils, curcumin, or turmeric. Curcumin comes from turmeric. Sulforaphanes that come from broccoli. I'm on a roll here, and I'm trying to. Let's see. Vitamin D, curcumin, fish oils, sulforaphanes. I'm missing something really important. What is it? What am I missing this for? I'll come back to it. I don't remember
okay.
what it is at the moment.
Aloe, glutamine, resveratrol.
Glutamine, thank you.
Glutamine, okay.
Glutamine, that's the other one. Those are the top five. And there are many others like aloe and resveratrol. There are many others that have an anti-inflammatory benefit. But those are the top five that have been shown in study after study after study to be powerful anti-inflammatories, and they're classified as selective kinase response modulators. Because of that, and because you have to do this for a year to 2 years, I mean, it takes a long time to put the fire out. The technical thing is you're healing intestinal permeability. 100% of patients with gluten sensitivity have intestinal permeability a year on a gluten-free diet. 45% of celiac patients, 9.7 years average on a gluten-free diet, 45% of them still have intestinal permeability. This is why there's increased mortality, is because the shags grow back, but they have leaky gut. They're still permeable, and that stimulates the entire autoimmune cascade, and that's another lecture that we'll get into. So you have to do this polynutraceutical approach, and what happens is that people start off, I mean, they get it. As they talk to their doctors or healthcare practitioners or nutritionists, they say, okay, I'll do this. And they take their 5 to 7 nutrients, and, you know, they open the bottle every day, and they take the things they feel good. But after a while, it gets to be a nuisance to open 5 to 7 bottles a day.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real nuisance, and people run out of something. They don't renew it right away, and they'll get it next time. And then eventually they're taking 3 things, maybe 3 or 4 out of the 7, and they think they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're missing the number of pathways because they're not taking the glutamine anymore or whatever it should be. So I put together, because I saw this for years, so I put together a pack. They're called the Gluten Sensitivity Support Packs.
I saw it. It rocks. Now, can they get that on your website?
They can. It's one pack a day. And you take one pack a day for a year to 2 years to put the fire out. Of course, stop throwing gasoline on the fire, and then
right.
take the Gluten Sensitivity Support Packs, one pack a day.
Because,
they are,
I mean,
really
I
cool.
Think some of the takeaways here are, I believe this, I think the best trial for checking if you have a problem with gluten is to take gluten out of your diet.
Yes.
How quickly would you notice the difference? And to do a symptoms quiz so that you really, we're so used to feeling eh and thinking eh is good, you
mm-hmm.
know? So I think you got to look at all these symptoms. I have people take a symptoms quiz, yank it, and then revisit it in a couple of weeks and see what's different, and then give it a little trial. And usually you know really quickly.
That's really good. That's very accurate, right? And within 3 weeks, we say 3 weeks is a good trial. However, I have to caution you on that. There's a reason I have to put caution in there. That is, when people notice they feel better, like their headaches go away or their migraines two or three times a week have gone down to, I've only had one in 3 weeks, Doc, and so they feel much better, they're very grateful. It starts slipping back into their diet again because they're basing it on symptoms. And if
they
feel
fine,
they
don't believe it. They have a test that tells them it's real. I mean, I just was reading some interesting studies on the compliance when you have a test that tells you. So, okay, so then we have the trial. It would be great to do the test. They can get the testing information on your website. And then let me think of another, I mean, because I'd like to give them a couple other, like what are some, any strategies you have for them, especially with like, you know, dining out and traveling?
I have a DVD that we put together. It's 2.5 hours of my presenting on this topic to a general public audience with lots of studies and the explanation of the big picture of how this can affect the entire body. And then my friend Susan Vess, who's a nutritionist, is on the DVD saying, how do you begin a gluten-free diet? And you need to, you know, it's kind of like, what's a good analogy for this? If you're a baseball player, and you want to go to the next level of baseball, you know, to be a better player, you hire a coach, right? And the coach shows you that the way if you're a pitcher, the way you bring your elbow back to throw your fastball, just pull that elbow a little bit. And then all of a sudden you see, my gosh, I've just improved 10%. I've really made a difference in my pitch, my fastball. The same thing is true when you're learning to eat differently. You need a coach. You need a coach. You can't read a piece of paper and do this because, well, you might be able to, but gluten has been a part of your life, your entire life, a major part. It's the most common food that people eat is wheat. So you need a coach. You need someone that knows about this. You need J.J. Virgin.
You know? I think a lot of these people listening have been in our coaching program, so they know. I mean, and this research is really starting to come out now showing that, you know, when you hire a coach, your results are so much better just in any times of behavior compliance. But I'll tell you, I'd love you to address these, the ones I hear all the time. So we give them all the places gluten high, we give them menu suggestions, we tell them all the different gluten-free products. They're going out to dinner. They're traveling. What are your strategies? What are a couple of your, because we're going to wrap this up, but your best tips, because those are the ones I get asked the most, on traveling, dining out. What do you say?
Yes, good. It's really not too hard. Traveling and dining out, unless you're sure of where you're dining, and if you want to be sure, you ask the chef to come out. And you say, what? Ask the chef to come out. I need to talk to him. And many of my patients and friends do that. And the chef comes out and says, hi, I have a gluten sensitivity. I need to know what you do for that. And then if the guy says, oh, yes, no problem, you know, we've got, you know, and if you're not sure, then you just order very safely. But sometimes a chef comes out and they look you in the eye and they're very proud of how conscious they are about this. So unless you're that sure about where you are, you just order things that no way would have any gluten. Like you have really nice salads with olive oil and vinegar dressing. You have vegetable dishes. You have meats that don't have dark sauces on them. Chicken and things like that don't have any dark sauces. So there's no soy sauce or there's no flavorings that would have gluten. Now you just order as carefully and consciously as you can. Also, there are applications now for your PMAs, you know, your smartphones, that you can download for free, gluten-free foods around the country. And whatever city you're in, you just click on it, and you put in your zip code, and it'll tell you what restaurants in the area have gluten-free menus.
And they even had that. I was told they had this, and I was there. I had to check it myself. I was in Italy, and they had gluten-free. And I'll tell you, I ate gluten in Italy, and it didn't hurt me at all because they don't, you know, GMO glutenize their food.
You didn't have any symptoms, but I can guarantee you that the autoimmune mechanism got inflamed.
Okay, well, I got inflamed and I feel it.
Right.
But, you know, it's like here if I eat a little bit, I noticed it right away. There I was like, okay, I didn't eat much. I was like, it's not killing me.
Right, it's the difference between an M80 and a stick of dynamite.
Okay, so I wasn't going around eating grenades and
eating exactly.
Bullets.
Exactly.
But it's now you threw me off my game here, Tom.
Oh, sorry, JJ. I just want to make sure your readers don't think it's okay.
Yeah, it's not okay. Do not eat pizza in Italy. But what I was going to tell you is it was interesting because they had quite a lot of restaurants that advertised gluten-free pasta and gluten-free pizza in Rome.
Yes.
I thought, how cool is that?
Yes, yes.
So cool.
And the concierge in your hotels, they know. The gluten-free restaurants know. I mean, because the government finances gluten-free. That if you have a diagnosis of celiac disease, the government will actually, it's like food stamps. You get food stamps for gluten-free food, and you can buy it in any store there. You're an Italian citizen. Yeah, I mean, they check children at birth for the gene if their parents have this, and the government pays for it so that parents know right away. They're very, very conscious about this. So you can travel now. You can use your PDAs, smartphones here in this country to find restaurants that are very conscious about it. You call the chef out, you look them in the eye and say, tell me what you do for gluten-free.
And
many
you can
restaurants
check those. I've been checking all the menus because like P.F. Chang's, I mean, a lot of them have gluten-free menus now.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And
exactly
it's just
right.
awesome. So, and I bet you anything, Tom, that you have had some impact there and you're just beginning. So, you know, it's like you're leading the charge, and I just want to say we are also appreciative of that because this message needs to get out there, and I want everyone to, you know, use your site, pass your site along, thedoctor.com, thedr.com, although, you know, I'm going to keep harassing you because I really want you to be theglutenfreeguy.com. But, you know, that needs to get out, and for anyone who wants to know more, share that website with them because it's got amazing resources, and as you can tell, Dr. O'Brien's got a great way of explaining this message with, you know, you got a little technical in there, but we could understand you, so that's all great. Because that's usually the most difficult thing is people start talking about intestinal villi and cytokines, and you're like, you know, you've already,
Greek.
You're going to go watch Sex in the City, right?
Right.
So you did a great job with that. So thank you so much for your time. I totally appreciate that. We'll be sending this out. And again, everybody, it's Dr. Thomas O'Brien, thedoctor.com. Thanks.
Thank you, JJ.